UK Wine Show, show number 42, Matt Skinner. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 42 for the 16th of March. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're talking with sommelier and wine personality Matt Skinner. Matt is the sommelier at Jamie Oliver's 15 restaurants and is in charge of wine for all the other restaurants that Jamie has dotted around the world. On a sight aside, I hope you've been enjoying the World Cup. I've just enjoyed watching the New Zealand-England game. And whilst this is a UK wine show, I'd just like to say, go the Black Caps! So, from breaking news in the cricket world to the latest wine news, let's have Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. US authorities have launched a criminal investigation into the sale of counterfeit wine at auction. They have subpoenaed Christie's in London and Zaccheaus in New York, as well as some of the big collectors of rare wine. The inquiry by the Department of Justice and the FBI was disclosed by the Wall Street Journal last week. It is focusing on whether auction houses and collectors knowingly sold counterfeit wines despite doubts about their authenticity. Christie's said it had been cooperating with the FBI and that it does not sell any lot that it knows or has reason to believe is unauthentic or counterfeit. This applies to all property offered for sale around the world, whether it be fine art, motor cars, furniture or wine. Part of the federal inquiry allegedly stems from an ongoing legal case in the States concerning the authenticity of bottles that supposedly came from the cellar of the third American president, Thomas Jefferson. However, there is a general worry that an increasing number of counterfeit bottles are circulating as the market for rare wine booms. It's anyone's guess how wide a problem it is. Some bottles might have been faked years ago and could still be laying undetected in cellars. Meanwhile, in Bordeaux, at least 7 of the 11 Saint-Emilion chateaux demoted in the 2006 classification are going to court to try to have the decision overturned. They have been spurred on by a Bordeaux court's recent decision to repeal the 2003 Cru Bourgeois classification. This basically returns the Medoc ratings to their original 1932 status. Saint-Emilion's classification system, which grades individual properties, was formally drawn up in 1955 and is the most frequently amended, reclassifying the chateau every 10 years. However, chateau demoted in the latest revision have criticised the fact that they have been given no reasons as to why they were declassified, and some feel that the jury broke the rules. Chateau Ville-Marine is one of the properties going to court to fight the decision. Managing Director Philippe Giraud told us the commission in charge of the 2006 classification did not follow the rules. The judgment was made solely on tasting, he said, and the vintages of the wines tasted are already out of stock and no longer on sale. The wines which are on the market are not included in the classification ratings. At family-owned Chateau Godet Saint-Julien, Guy Petrus Lignac is equally aggrieved, saying the chateau has always been considered as Grand Cru Classé. He is proud of its excellent terroir and since taking over the winery from his parents in 2000, says he's put in a lot of investment to keep it at the highest level. He said the only criterion considered for all the 11 demoted wineries was a very subjective tasting. While the rules are supposed to take criteria such as maintenance of the vines, terroir and notoriety into consideration. But the rules aren't really clear, he said. Even the president of the Saint-Emilion Syndicate said the rules are too blurred and are subject to discussion. And finally this week, Ernest Gallo, who with his brother Julio helped build the American wine industry, has died aged 97. Ernest Gallo was the co-founder of the Gallo Winery, the company that virtually put Californian wine on the map. Ernest started the business in 1933 after both his parents died deeply in debt, brought down by the Depression in America. He saw an opportunity with the impending end of Prohibition, and with less than $6,000 and the help of Julio, he set out to create an empire. In its first year, with the brothers often working round the clock, the winery was in profit. Ernest looked after the sales, marketing and distribution, and Julio the winemaking. The launch of the cheap fortified wine Thunderbird in the 50s escalated their business, and in the mid-1970s they entered the premium wine market. The company continued to grow, acquiring vineyards and expanding its wineries, storage and distribution facilities. And when the domestic market started to stagnate in the 1980s, Gallo turned to the export markets, particularly Britain, in promoting its wines. By 2000, the company was selling around 50 million bottles of wine to the UK a year. Today, Gallo employs more than 4,600 people and markets its wines in more than 90 countries. Its grapes are grown throughout California's wine-growing regions from Napa to the Central Valley. Giulio died in an accident in 1993, but Ernest continued to be active in the business well into his 90s and retained control until his death last week in Modesto, California. He was one of the country's wealthiest men, listed on the Forbes magazine list of 4,000 richest Americans, with a family worth of $1.3 billion. That's all for the news this week, but 60 years ago, in 1947, there was concern about the decline of European viticulture, which still hadn't recovered from the Second World War. France, Italy, Greece, Romania, Hungary, Germany and Austria were all struggling, and so was Spain as a result of the Civil War. Vine growing throughout a vast amount of Europe was hampered by uprooted and aging vines, as well as a lack of available labour and fertilisers. That's all this week, Chris. Back over to you.
Thanks for that, Jane. I think fine wine prices reflect more about the quality of the world economy than they do about the quality of the wine inside. Also, given that the Bank of England's just released another £20 note to try and stop counterfeiters there, it's not surprising that they find it easy to counterfeit a label, which is pretty simple to do. So there's no surprise anywhere that the world is awash with counterfeit wine. What is concerning is that the auction houses have let the wine sell. So whilst you can't expect the auction house to guarantee the provenance of the wine, you'd hope that they don't sell wine knowing that it is counterfeit. It's not a new story. Wine fraud is probably about as old as wine. And I think the only thing you can really say is, if you are spending a lot of money on buying wine at auction, let the buyer beware. Next up is the interview with Matt Skinner, sommelier and wine personality.
Hi, I'm here with Matt Skinner, famous man from 15 Restaurant. How are you, Matt?
Good, mate. How are you?
Not too bad. It's quite nice having a Kiwi and an Aussie, aren't
it? Yeah, it is. As long as we don't talk about rugby or kind of... Yeah, exactly right.
Matt was telling me all about his sheep jokes earlier. I was well impressed.
Yeah, the statistics are amazing on New Zealanders and sheep. But we're
going to talk about wine this time.
Yeah, I think so. I think Australia's probably got more sheep than New Zealand.
But per head of population,
exactly. I think you win.
In New Zealand, we're never giving them the vote. I can tell you, we'll never get anywhere. So, how did you get into wine? It was in Australia, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I finished my final year of school. I, like most Aussie kids, decided to have a year off and got a job in a local wine shop. Wanted a job in a bar, actually, and ended up working in a wine shop. Obviously, like in New Zealand, you know, our pubs have got bottle shops attached to them.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, I sort of thought, well, that'll be a means to sort of getting my foot in the door to work in the bar. And started working in this bottle shop. And I had absolutely no passion or desire to work with wine whatsoever. And I had a boss who sort of had other ideas. And, you know, I was fortunate enough that I thought it was the best job in the world. I used to rock up to work and help myself to a beer out of the fridge, order a pizza, pay for it out of the till, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And one day I sort of turned up and he sat me down in his office and played back some CCTV footage of me in fast forward. It would even look bad in fast forward, you know. It's just sort of like, he said, you've kind of got two options. You can either get serious and, you know, learn a little bit about what it is that we're trying to do here. Otherwise, you can just disappear and waste someone else's time. So he was actually, I think that was pretty lenient, really.
Yeah.
I would have just got rid of me straight away. But, you know, and so I sort of took the first option, and he opened a couple of bottles of wine for me. And I just assumed that all wine sort of tasted the same. Red was red and white was white, and how wrong I was, And that's kind of, I guess that's where it started. I didn't really get passionate, you know, then and there. But at the same time, I was really, I guess, sort of intrigued as to why things, you know, why three white wines tasted all completely different from one another.
Yeah.
Even back then. And, you know, I just went on with it.
And how, that was 16, 17?
I was 18 at the time. So yeah, 13 years ago. Okay. And, you know, I've since then, I think the next thing I did was when I came to the UK. And
when was that?
That was sort of, it must have been 1994, came to the UK. And it was bizarre because, you know, UK listeners will know that back then Odd Bins were really kind of in their prime. They were doing some amazing stuff. And I remember going into actually Odd Bins in Highgate Village of all places, and I had to buy a thank you present for the people that I'd been staying with. I was completely skint, and I was about to head home with my tail between my legs because I'd run out of money and sort of run out of time. And I remember going into this Odd Bins and thinking, well, I'm going to know most of the wines in here. I've done a little bit of work in a bottle shop. You know, how much is there to know, you know?
Yeah, and obviously...
quite cocky. And, you know, went into this shop and just remember thinking, I'll buy them something Australian. And just going into this odd bins, and there was this just tiny little slither of a strip on the wall that was Australia. Then there was France, Italy, Germany, Spain, Austria, New Zealand, the States. And I thought, my God, I know a tiny little bit about a tiny little bit of the world of wine, you know, and that's it.
Lot bigger now.
You know, it's a lot bigger. You know, it's the wine industry's getting bigger all the time. Yeah, I know a little bit more now than I did then. But at the same time, I think almost in some ways that sort of gave me fuel for the fire. I was determined when I got back to Australia just to kind of just get into it and sort of immerse myself in it 120% and learn as much about other parts of the world as I could, you know, alongside Australia.
So did you go back to the bottle shop or what did you do?
I went and worked for a group, actually, a chain that were a little bit like Odd Bins, actually. Yep. They were called Philip Murphy Wine and Spirits, and they were brilliant because they were growing.
State company or
Australian? Well, no, they were an Australian, just a privately owned company. They had about, at that stage, they had about 8 or 9 stores. Mm-hmm. And they were brilliant because for the first time, they were growing quite quickly. Yep. And for the first time, I got to work amongst a staff that were much my own age. So straight away, I could talk to other people about, you know, a common product.
Yep.
And, you know, I didn't feel stupid sort of asking questions. Secondly, this company wasn't so big that it had completely forgotten about its staff. They were really great at investing money back into staff education. And so I sort of was really lucky that I kind of just immersed myself in sort of all the different opportunities, training-wise, that
what you sort know, of they training? Offered. Because they don't have to do WSET in
no,
Australia.
No, but they had like always, every week, there'd be kind of at least 2 or 3 winemakers who'd come from somewhere.
Oh, nice. Yeah,
talk you know, like kind oil. Of... Yeah, Monday, Wednesday and Friday nights, there'd always be a winemaker in the shop and that would coincide with in-store tastings, but they'd always do a separate one for staff. And that was great. And, you know, back then everyone was kind of really enthusiastic. So kind of there'd be at least 20 or 30 people there and they'd come from other stores as well with such, you know, with kind of 8 or 9 stores in the group.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and they also offered opportunities like when wine shows like the Victorian Wine Show was on, they'd offer opportunities to get staff to go along and act as stewards so that we'd do all the hard work, we'd do all the manual labour and pour brackets, wines and stuff like that. But the flip side was that we got to taste everything as well after the show had finished, and we got to also, I guess, be in the company for the first time of, you know, some really iconic people in the Australian industry. So it was a really amazing time.
And how long were you there for?
I worked with those guys for... God, it must have been sort of 2.5 years. Yep. And then I met sort of my mentor along the way there, a guy who he was responsible for imported wine for the group. And imported wine makes up a really small slice of the pie in Australia.
Yeah.
You know, we're pretty parochial drinkers. And it's the same all over the world. You know, he was really quick to sort of say, I think he saw that I was enthusiastic. I was going to all the tastings. And he just said, you know, if you're serious about this, then you kind of owe it to yourself to sort of know not just about Australian Riesling, know about Riesling from Germany, from Austria, from New Zealand, from Alsace, you know. And I sort of thought, really? Okay, cool. And I, you know, that coupled with my experience in the Odd Bins in Highgate, I guess inspired me to just make sure that I never became complacent just drinking the same old thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, this guy left the company and went and worked for a sort of a restaurant group in Melbourne. I thought, oh God, well, he was kind of my inspiration. You know, he'd opened some amazing bottles for me and I got to try all sorts of different stuff. And pretty quickly he came back and said, you know, this job's bigger than just me. I need an assistant. Would you come along and be my assistant?
Oh, so fantastic.
I went. We worked together, you know, at a number of Melbourne restaurants. The Prince in Melbourne, Circa, the restaurant there, has a wine list of kind of 1,300 wines. And I got a chance to work on that. We opened a small boutique wine store together called Prince Wine Store in Melbourne. We have a restaurant called Stoke House in Melbourne on St Kilda Beach, which had sort of 2 levels and 2 very different wine lists. And for the first time, I got to do a bit of staff training and get involved with sort of people, again, my own age, but sort of try and pass on a little bit of what I'd learned to that date.
You would have found it quite hard, though, to get hold of a lot of European wines. You know, in Australia, there is a lot of Aussie wines, a lot of Kiwi wines as well.
Absolutely. You
know, when I came to Europe, I was like a kid in a candy store. It was like, great. But in New Zealand, we got New Zealand wines, Aussie wines. If we were lucky, we got a bit of real ropey Chianti in a funny wicker basket. Yeah, and that was about it.
Yeah. Do you know what? We were really lucky. And I think Melbourne's probably the exception to the rule, just purely because we've got this amazing, we've always had this really lovely history of food and wine in Melbourne. And we, you know, I remember, I don't know whether it has any significance at all, but my grade two class, you know, I was 7 years old, you know, it was made up of about four Chinese kids, four Greek kids, a couple of Italian kids, you know, and about three Australian kids. And that was kind of it. And that's, you know, to a large extent, that's what kind of Melbourne is. It's this melting pot of culture.
Yeah.
And so as a result, we've kind of always had a really strong interest in food.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously along with that comes an interest in wine. And so I think we're really fortunate in Melbourne to have a handful of really good importers, you know, guys who really went out of their way to kind of pick the eyes out of it sort of in the late 80s, early 90s. And they were importing all the great stuff. And it was, and you know, we kind of owe a lot to those guys because not a lot has turned up in Australia. You know, by the time things got to Australia, they were always, they'd been refined. We kind of got the best of everything.
Yeah.
Even though it still made up less than kind of 10% of sales.
We got exposure to
great things.
And so when did you finish up there?
While I was working for those guys, I worked with them for 5 years, and in 2000 I applied for a scholarship, a trade-based scholarship called the Negotiants Wine Fellowship, which is offered to anyone working in the Australian wine industry. And it's a year-long program where you kind of obviously continue doing your day job, but at certain points of the year in your city, you go along and you do kind of a series of workshops with visiting winemakers from different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You do a series of sensory evaluation exams, and you do kind of a written exam as well. And so I applied for that, and I think around about 1,000 people apply around the country, and they take about 100 applicants on the course. And I was lucky enough to get into the 100. And I sort of thought, well, I've got this great opportunity. I'm going to make the most of it. I'll just sort of throw myself at it again. And there were points, the areas of the course that I highlighted straight away, which were going to be my downfalls. Writing was going to be the first one because, you know, typical kind of Matt Skinner thing was always to submit stuff, you know, 2 days after it was due and usually, you know, on a bit of paper and written down hastily. Yeah. It was always bad.
And crayon?
Crayon, yeah. Otherwise, the dog had ate it, you know, and, I'd kind of never hand it in. So that was the first thing I was going to really work on. And then, you know, the sensory evaluation exams as well. I've always been a really keen taster. So it was just sort of refining that and sort of really focusing and trying to taste as much as I could. And I was lucky enough that, you know, I delivered my written piece and came back. It got marked. I got 18.5 out of 20. And for me, you know, I was kind of elated.
Yeah.
If it had stopped there, that would have been fantastic. And I put my heart and soul into it and wrote a piece about why wine lovers drink wines from, you know, all over the world and not just from Australia. Something quite close to my heart. And then I found out I made the final, and they took the 100 down to 10 from applicants from around the country. And I thought, well, you know, got nothing to lose now. I'm going to really have a go.
Yeah, yeah.
And the final was kind of like, you know, 10 people, they all came to Melbourne. You know, we sat in front of a panel of kind of the likes of James Halliday, you know, Len Evans, all those guys.
Yes,
and sort of they just put you through the ringer. And it was sort of like, you know, answer questions on this and this and this, and why do you think you should be the one? And, you know, here's kind of four wines, you know, tell us about them. And it was kind of, everything was blind and...
Yeah.
We had no idea what they were, so it was on the spot. You didn't have any time with the wines; you just had to do it in front of these guys as you went in as you would for a job interview. Really, you know, I went along to the presentation that dinner that night, and James Halliday's kind of making the announcements, and the next thing I hear my name, and it was like, you know, I was like, wow, and it was me. I'd won it. I thought I was dreaming. You know, for my trouble, I got a 5 week, you know, all expenses paid trip around Europe and visiting France, Italy, Germany and Spain. And, you know, to visit producers who I'd read about, you know, in books and whose wines I'd tasted. But these guys were kind of my heroes. And I got my first ever chance to sort of go to the source, so to speak, and properly understand it. So that gave me inspiration like nothing else, you know. And when I came back to Australia, I sort of thought, oh, how am I going to use this experience? What can I do? I really want to go on and go forward with this. And I was keen to get back to the UK and work in the UK because obviously it's the most important consumer wine market on the planet.
It's one of the big hubs of wine world.
Amazing, you know, and spoilt for choice with what you can learn and taste here. And, you know, I met one of my best mates had just come back from the UK. He's a chef and just been working at a restaurant called the River Cafe. And he sort of said to me, look, a mate of mine's coming out from London. He's a chef. He's just got a book out. You know, he's got a television series. It's all kind of kicking off. We're going to catch up for dinner. Do you want to come? And I thought, yeah, great. Free meal. No worries. And, you know, we have a great classic. Yeah, totally. Anything for a free meal. You know, we had no idea who Jamie was. We'd kind of never seen the books or the TV programs. It hadn't happened for him in Australia at that stage. And so, you know, I went along to this dinner and I remember I sat opposite him and I was amazed at kind of when he talked about food, you know, it was almost like someone plugged him into a wall. You know, he just became incredibly animated and, you know what that's like. You've seen it, I guess, on television. And I mean, that's the real him, you know, and he's incredibly passionate about what he does. And I sort of thought, you know what, I feel like that. I feel like that about what I do. And we just kind of clicked and kept in contact. And he started talking about the concept of 15, which back then was sort of a corner store idea with about three or four tables, one student, Jamie running the show and cooking. And the ethos behind it was the same. It was about taking disadvantaged students and offering them, you know, a year of training and development. Yeah. And I really believed in that. And I thought that was great. And that was kind of, for me, how I'd come through the industry. I guess I'd been given some great opportunities and had to try to make the most of them. And I thought, great, and a chance to get to London and really, you know, learn some stuff. So, you know, I came to the UK about 4.5 years ago and
All kicked off. Brilliant. You've had what? You've written one book on wine itself and two juices now, haven't you?
Two juices, yeah. So, you know, the writing, again, it's not something I hang my hat on. I don't by any means be the first to admit that I'm not a great writer, but I love communicating. I love talking, and I write very much as I speak, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's something that I get a lot of. It's almost therapeutic for me, you know, writing. I sort of take my laptop with me everywhere and just, you know, plug away, two finger tapping as I do.
Yeah.
I still work on the floor 3 days a week. We have 4:15s now.
Is that training or is it actually
Actually serving. Yeah. Yeah. We have 4:15s. We have London, Cornwall, Melbourne, and Amsterdam. And I oversee wine operations for the group now, but I still work 3 days a week on the floor in London. I think it's really important, it's a really vital part of my job to have face-to-face interaction with the consumer
Otherwise,
you just become removed from it, and it's very easy to lose touch. You know what that's like. And I think for me, to listen to how people talk about wine, to see what they're drinking, you know, to just try and understand better how they think about it, I think we take for granted sometimes, you know, how little actually people know about this product.
Yeah, it's about making sure you can communicate at the right level for the person.
Absolutely.
But you've got a reputation as a bit of a surfy dude. How do you deal with it here? You know, Cornwall, it's a fair hard haul.
Yeah. I dream about it a lot. I watch a lot of extreme TV on cable.
Do you surf?
Yeah, I do. But obviously my opportunities to do that here are few and far between because I live in central London, a long way away.
5 hour drive.
Yeah, so, you know, I try and nip off every now and again. You know, it's easier to almost fly and go to somewhere like Spain or France, and that works okay. I try to, get the odd part of my job description is to get to the other branches, so I go to Cornwall probably more than I go to Amsterdam at the moment. But, you know, it's I try to do it whenever I can. I snowboard quite a bit as well, and that's a bit easier to do in Europe than it is in Australia anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
So, yep.
No, brilliant. And what do you got coming up next year?
Next year's hopefully it's a bit quieter. We opened 2 restaurants this year and I had a baby and wrote a book, so I kind of hope next year's a little bit quieter.
Yeah?
So, yeah.
How old's your little kid?
I've got a little girl. Her name's Indy. She's 10 months old. Yeah, she's unbelievable. She's great. And I am
more months, she'll actually start getting some feedback from her.
Yeah, exactly. Then I'll be in for it. Next year I've got, obviously I'm doing a bit of travel for work. I've got 2 books out at the end of next year, another edition of The Juice and another big book. And so I'm sort of working madly on sort of finishing those at the moment. We've got probably the most exciting thing next year is that I guess... for the first time, we're going to take a past student, a graduate of 15, and we're going to put them through a wine course, and they're going to work with us for 12 months. And they'll work in the wine department, and we're taking a guy called John, who's passionate about wine, really enthusiastic, but at a really basic level.
Yeah.
And he'll work with us, and we'll just see where we can get him. He's going to do his sort of basic, intermediate, and advanced course at the WSET. He'll spend a bit of time picking grapes, hopefully in an English vineyard as well, just to kind of see what see what it's about. I think that's really important.
Mold and mildew.
Yeah, he'll be an expert. You know, but at the same time, he's going to do a bit of work retail as well. A couple of independent retailers, probably the guys down at Phil Glass and Swigert, he'll spend a bit of time with.
Yeah, good.
You know, and ideally, it's just to immerse him in as much as we possibly can over those 12 months, so that by the end of the 12 months, who knows where he'll be? But you know, maybe he'll work out that wine's not for him. But if nothing else, he's had a great experience over 12 months anyway.
It's quite good, eh? Majestic are quite good from their training point of view. It's good you guys are giving other people opportunities, all that sort of stuff.
You know, it's just, you know, look, we have the resources to be able to do it, so we can and we will.
All right, we'll leave it there, Matt.
Cool.
Cheers very much.
Cheers, mate. It's great. Great. It's good to speak to you.
Yeah, excellent.
Cool.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Matt. He's a nice bloke, and his latest wine recommendation book, Juice 2007, is on shelves at the moment. Next week, we're going to be talking about soils. They're pretty important when it comes to growing grapes, and a lot of people talk about various soils, but they don't really understand what the difference is. We'll be looking a wee bit about the soils in England, and also why some of them are more suitable than others. So until then, cheers, and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show was brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show was produced by Jane Scott and recorded and edited by Chris Scott. The news was read by Jane Scott and researched by Sandra Clement. The music for the UK Wine Show is Griff to Jingle 1 by Marcel de la Jatelle and Silence by Etoile Noire.